Welcome everybody to the Friday edition of the Damage Report. We're about to close it out with Brett Ehrlich. Brett, good to have you here. Love your jacket, Brett.
It is so important that everyone knows that this is the only jacket I leave at the office.
I have a big pile, but I like that jacket.
Thank you. I got it.
It's good for the news. It's good for teaching philosophy courses.
Here's how you shop at Zara, John.
Okay.
For those of you listening to the podcast, there's patches on the elbow. That's why he said it. But here's how you shop at Zara. You walk into Zara and go, this place is so stupid. Everything is leathery and dumb. Oh, that looks nice.
I did go into a Zara once, I think, on Francis's recommendation.
Nope. Move on.
I felt the same way. Okay, so here's what's going to happen on the show. I'm just going to start the show. I happened to come across a tweet that angered me. Now, we've all heard the, how are you going to pay for it? So much that it's like a joke now at this point. Like, you're seriously, you're still saying, how are you going to pay for it? Like, you don't understand the hypocrisy inherent in that. It's like early 2019's what about? It's like, do you not get the context of what, we know what you're doing psychologically, but generally it comes from either Republicans or from Jake Tapper. Mm. But now it's coming from inside of the house with Nancy Pelosi saying, how do you pay for that on Medicare for all? If we could bring up that tweet, you're gonna see the Hill. So I don't blame the Hill in this particular case. That's just a quote that she said. And that comes, by the way, after over 100 House Democrats have signed on to a plan led by Pramila Jayapal, who's been on the show, that would create a system of Medicare for all. And her response is, but come on, Republican talking points.
That's what's so frustrating about it. And it is so easy to avoid it. And I always hear all these arguments that Nancy Pelosi is this master legislator who really is able to identify what's going on at all times and operate in a way that is pragmatic and expedient for her party's interest. In this, I earnestly believe that that aspect of it hasn't gotten through to her. That like, no, this is okay to talk about now. Mm-hmm. This is okay to advocate for. And there's also, incidentally, answers to this question.
She could figure it out.
Well, there's answers. And
theoretically.
As we talk about, there's more and more people getting into the presidential race right now. Mm-hmm. The governor of Washington, Inslee, just got into it today. And a lot of them are going to be asked, what's your plan on this? Bernie Sanders, you could just go read it. And he actually says how you would pay for Medicare for all. So you would just go on his website. And people say that all the time. Like, go check out our website. And you're like, how am I going to find it? How's it going to really tell me? Is it going to be BS, like bullet points of nothingness? And the answer is no. It's actually like amounts of money that this would cost and how much it would save you in the long run.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And she is helping to prop up not just the general how you're going to pay for it, but the specific, but it's so expensive talking points. So she said, that is administratively, Medicare for all, the simplest thing to do. But to convert to it, $30 trillion? Now, how do you pay for that? Now, again, as we've said a million times, the current system is more expensive than that. They just pretend that it's $30 trillion additional dollars, which does seem crazy if that was true. That would scare me too. Turns out it's not, but Nancy Pelosi either doesn't know that or doesn't want you to know that. She also says, all I want is the goal of every American having access to healthcare. You don't get there by dismantling the Affordable Care Act. That is wrong in two competing ways. One, yes, that is exactly how we could get to that, by dismantling the ACA and replacing it with Medicare for All or one of the other competing single-payer healthcare plans. That is exactly how you would get there. And also, we have had the Affordable Care Act for literally years now. Everyone is not covered. So I would react to her by saying, well, how do you get there by maintaining the status quo with the ACA?
No. She wants to mantle it. Maybe mantle it. Take up the mantle and make it better. But what's your plan for that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure the only person that has said that they have a plan for that is Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated to see what that would look like. And if it's a good plan, fine. Mm-hmm. Medicare for all is a way to communicate. We want universal health care. And we have a version of that for a certain age group, that is mm-hmm. Medicare, and we want to expand it
yeah.
over a certain amount of time. We want to mantle it, incrementally, mm-hmm. one finger of the mantle at a time.
Yeah, well, so I would say that incrementally is some people are saying that. Others like Pramila Jayapal are saying, The reason that it has to be a switchover to Medicare for all, for everyone, rather than something that takes place over time, is that if it were to take place over time, that would provide time for the insurance companies to jack up prices and all of that.
Right, and I'm saying a certain amount of time, that amount of time could be overnight. It just varies from person to person.
Yeah. And by the way, I said earlier that I wasn't gonna blame The Hill, but I am gonna blame them a little bit, because they also wrote, and this is not a quote, this is just something they wrote, "The roughly $30 trillion price tag over 10 years of single-payer health insurance, sometimes referred to as Medicare for All, has been one of the leading criticisms of the proposal." That is true. That is one of the leading criticisms that has been responded to, and you're pretending that it hasn't been, and you're just putting it out there as if, a big deal. That's a big problem. How are they going to deal with that?
And the answer is the current system costs more than that, and we are paying for it now through your employer, through private insurance, who are funding private insurance companies and all that. And there's a lot of problems with that. And yes, if you talk to doctors, they actually say, well, do you want to expand Medicaid for all? No, not as much as I would for Medicare for all, because that makes more sense for hospitals.
Yeah. Let's turn now to another thing that was frustrating me. We were talking earlier this week about this like PR campaign for billionaires that's been going on this year. As people are starting to talk about wealth taxes, higher estate tax, things like that, there is a pushback to tell us to once again worship our billionaire overlords. And I saw this tweet, which seems perfectly benign. So CNN Business tweeted, "Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos donated $2 billion to charity last year, more than anyone else in the world." Which is that good. They donated to charity, and apparently it was to boost nonprofits that help homeless families. That's good. That is good news. But it's not just good news that doesn't exist in any sort of context. I mean, after all, we've been talking about specifically that the charity coming from billionaires is often seems to be used as a way to fend off calls for them to actually pay taxes. And Jeff Bezos in particular gets away with quite a lot when it comes to taxes for him and his corporation. But think about that amount. So Avi Asher Shapiro on Twitter sort of compared that percentage that they donated to what a regular person like you or I would have to donate to do the same thing, 1.5% of their net worth, because these people have more than $100 billion. That's the same as a regular person under 35 donating $160 to charity. Now look, if you're only making, you know, if you're working a minimum wage job and you still find time to donate a couple hundred dollars to charity, that is a very admirable act. But that's not like, you're not Superman, you're not Spider-Man at that point. Like, let's not pretend that because they gave 1.5% of their net worth away, that we don't need to have conversations about taxation, about a, you know, wealth tax and all of that.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is counterbalanced. Well, I don't really buy into the like, what percentage of your overall wealth are you giving away? Because if you want it to be a sustainable model year after year, it's going to be based on your income that year and what you're worth any given year as it pertains to how much wealth you're replenishing.
You have over $100 billion.
And I think through
that, income is probably pretty good.
I think there's a different mathematical way to do it, because this is $160. It is kind of interesting to say it's $160 from an average millennial who has $11,000. And let's also talk about how $11,000 is not a lot to have, because this isn't Gen Z. This is millennials who are now in their 30s. I am the world's oldest millennial, and I turned 37 today. So just to put it in perspective, I also want you to know that I share a birthday with Justin Bieber.
That, I think, is the most important thing you will learn today. Amazing fact of the day, brought to you by Brett Ehrlich. Related in a spiritual sense to Justin Bieber. And by the way, zooming out from Jeff Bezos, the top 50 donors on the Chronicle of Philanthropy list donated roughly 50% less last year than last year. Overall donations from the world's 50 top donors dropped from $14.7 billion in 2017 to $7.8 billion in 2018.
Which is precisely the opposite of what they are trying to convince us they would do with a new tax system.
Yeah, which we got. I mean, this is international, to be fair, but in the US, their taxes were significantly cut last year, and they donated far less.
Yes, that is very frustrating.
That is very frustrating. And also, and again, remember, there are these people running around with gigantic fortunes and all of that, and doing some good work for homeless families, but also maintaining a level of staggering wealth that would make, you know, the most well-off emperor of the ancient world blush. And we're having conversations about how are we gonna pay to stop people from dying unnecessarily from things that theoretically could be treated. But let's not talk about a wealth tax.
Right.
Okay? Estate tax, come on, let's not go crazy.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
It is very frustrating. I think that this is more we're better off in terms of talking about how to adjust the income tax system and the capital gains tax system to create what would be more than $2 billion from the Bezoses.
Yeah.
And I think, as Anand Giridharadas told the show multiple times, they're trying to convince us that this is a system that will work. Mm-hmm. There will be more money, and oh my God, the billionaires are philanthropists. We should be so grateful. It's like, I shouldn't have to depend on the generosity of Bezos. I should have a better system that taxes proportionately.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to depend. And according to the most recent numbers, you shouldn't depend, because it seems like some of that is drying up too. With that, we are going to take a break. When we come back, lots more to get.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So I feel like we've actually had a little bit of a period of time where Trump's cabinet has not been embroiled in scandal and controversy, but perhaps they should be right now. We're going to delve into one of the figures on that cabinet that has escaped some of the scrutiny that has taken down multiple other members of Trump's cabinet. And joining us to do that, Carrie Levine, a senior reporter for Center for Public Integrity. Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Glad to have you here. And I enjoyed your recent reporting on Wilbur Ross and some of his ethical and potentially legal issues. And I would love to have the audience better understand that. So one of the big issues apparently has to do with divesting a significant chunk of his assets, correct?
That's right. Wilbur Ross, when he took office, had agreed to divest assets by certain dates. And over the last couple of years, it's come out repeatedly that there were assets that perhaps he didn't realize he owned that he should have disclosed and divested, or assets he was supposed to divest by certain dates and divested later than that. And he's attributed those to inadvertent errors, but they're starting to pile up for him.
Yeah, and so during the shutdown, he made a couple of comments that seemed very, very disconnected from the reality of regular working people. I love the concept of this guy not knowing that he owns some assets worth potentially millions of dollars. So I guess my question is, when it comes to not divesting, obviously he is in an important position, you know, Commerce Secretary.
Right.
Do we have reason to believe that some of the actions he has taken as secretary have benefited him financially because of his continued ownership of these assets?
Well, I think that's the billion-dollar question. There's a bunch of things kind of coming into play here. One is that he's a cabinet-level official. He's involved at very high levels in trade and tariff negotiations and other things. And so it starts getting into these very technical questions about, well, what is a particular matter that could have a direct and predictable effect on his financial interests? Has he participated in anything like this? If ethics officials had realized he still owns some of these assets, would they have told him to recuse from things that he didn't recuse from? And these are things that are still getting unwound. And senators from both political parties have asked the Commerce Department's Inspector General, who's the chief watchdog for the department, to look into that very question. And I think we're all waiting for that.
So in your investigation of Wilbur Ross, outside of the assets that he should have divested, what other concerns did you unearth?
Well, I think what we found is that It's just very rare and very unusual for a cabinet level official to have ethics officials refuse to certify their financial disclosures. Essentially, this is something that is a really rare rebuke of a cabinet level official. It happens when they think the disclosures aren't accurate, when there's an investigation ongoing. And so that's the situation we find ourselves in with Wilbur Ross. Ethics officials have finally said, look, we just can't say that we think these reports are right. We can't say that they're complete. And we do not think that you're complying with the ethics agreement that you made when you took office. And so that is just a very unusual situation that we find ourselves in with Secretary Ross.
So putting the Commerce Secretary in the context of the rest of the cabinet and the White House, obviously there are concerns about a number of them. From the point of view of the Center for Public Integrity, based on the research that you've done during the Trump administration, how would you compare their commitment to traditional ethical norms in these areas where theoretically they could be personally financially benefiting from decisions in comparison to past administrations?
That's been a really striking thing that we found while reporting on this, and I'll tell you why. I have so rarely had ethics watchdogs say to us, you know, this case of Secretary Ross really says a lot to us about the administration's commitment to ethics and to ethics rules and to ethics norms. Because what we found is that the system has long relied on public pressure and political pressure for enforcement. You know, besides a public scolding, there's really very little ethics officials can do right now about Wilbur Ross and whether or not he's complying with this ethics agreement. They can ask him to do it. They can tell him he should do it. They can tell him he's eroding public trust if he does not do it. But there's really very few tools in the toolkit. And so what a lot of people said to us while we were reporting the story, which I reported together with Peter Overby of NPR, was, look, you know, in any other White House, someone would have picked up the phone and called and said, straighten this out, this can't happen again. And we really don't feel like that's happening here. And so the other thing people said is that Secretary Ross is an enormously wealthy man with complicated financial holdings, much like the president of the United States. And the difference here, though, is that there are laws that apply to everyone but the president of the United States that Secretary Ross has to comply with. And those, that's where the questions are. People are looking into whether he's done that.
So that is extremely interesting. And if policy is being set, if you know, if either laws are being pushed or behind the scenes regulations are being established in a way that is being biased by his own personal financial stake, that's obviously incredibly significant. What I'm curious is, though, we've had multiple members of his cabinet resign, you know, in a cloud of a number of different scandals, significant
yes,
all the way down to the silly. What do you think explains why Wilbur Ross has not received the same level of scrutiny?
I think that his disclosure issues are really a little wonky. You know, they're for people like me who like sitting there combing through dozens of pages of disclosures of you know, companies named like Alphabet Soup, right? Your average person is much going to be much more interested in a scandal over whether someone used a private jet on the government dime. And so I think that these just don't get as much attention because people think that they're kind of technical and boring. But it's interesting because ethics watchdogs are absolutely raising the alarm saying the Wilbur Ross case really should get more attention. And the reason is because these issues go to the heart of why we have ethics rules for government officials. We have these rules so that the public knows that public officials are acting in their interest, not in the public's interest, not in their own interest. And so if Wilbur Ross, in fact, didn't disclose everything he was supposed to disclose, if ethics officials weren't able to monitor him for conflicts, that goes to public trust in government, and that's important.
Well, and hopefully as a result of your investigation and reporting, there will be some renewed scrutiny on Secretary Ross. Carrie Levine of the Center for Public Integrity, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to. So more and more states are signing on to the idea that the popular vote should be what determines who becomes our president. And there's this interstate compact, which has 16 states on it. I think
16 is the
states.
Last number that I saw.
Somewhere around
that
there.
Might just be the number of women who have charged President Trump of sexual
That's
misconduct.
True.
So I have to work through that.
It's unrelated, but not entirely unrelated. And so that would be a big change. And some people support it, some people oppose it. Some who oppose it for interesting reasons. One of those is former Governor Paul LePage, a guy with an interesting past when it comes to racial matters. So he was on a conservative radio show because that's what he does now. And he was talking about this. And he said, what would happen if they do what they say they're gonna do is white people will not have anything to say. It's only going to be the minorities that would elect. It would be California, Texas, Florida.
I don't even know how to parse that sentence.
I have a few ideas.
It's a majority. This would be going from a weird system related to, like, all right, states break it up that has yielded a minority of voters electing the president. Mm-hmm. This would eliminate the Electoral College, which means it would be majority rules. Whites are the majority. And in what he seemed to imply is that you vote based on your race. There are more white people than non-white people. Mm-hmm. If the world works how you think it works, this is actually better for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, I would compare this to some of the sort of victim complex of some right-wing Christians in this country is you have to be able to maintain two thoughts simultaneously in your head, that you are the biggest, most dominant group, and that you are an embattled minority that everyone is attacking. And so that works for racial stuff too, I guess. So again, let's double down on what you said. He responds to this question, which has nothing specifically to do with race, assuming that the only consideration is how this will affect white people. So he thinks about any electoral change or a situation with voting rights, all that is viewed through an entirely racial lens, which is an interesting way to live your life, I think. He also talks about California, Texas, Florida. There are a lot of white people in those states. Has he not been there? I know he comes from a different part of the country, but there's so many white people in those places. He labeled the proposal an insane process and warned that we're gonna be forgotten people. Now, but the thing is, you have to believe, to say that, you have to believe that non-white people are lesser people, because you believe that the president being chosen based on what the largest group of Americans wants is not acceptable if that group is hypothetically in some future date made up of non-white people, that what they are choosing is inherently inferior to what would be chosen by white people.
No, I think it's just worse in his mind for white people. Mm-hmm. That's what he thinks it is, and that is inferior. I mean, I'm just saying that those are two possible ways to perceive it. And I do think that he doesn't want people that aren't like him choosing what happens. Mm-hmm. What has happened, the true response to this, is the Electoral College, well, it was set up, I'm sure, for practicalities purposes. It was slavery and disenfranchisement of black people that kept black people from having a voice. But now it seems like the Electoral College itself keeps a lot of people's voices from being heard. How many people? Well, just take how many people voted for Hillary Clinton and subtract the total number that Donald Trump had people vote for him. That number is who are being silenced through the Electoral College. There are also a ton of other ways in which people's voices are being silenced. Putting those together makes the Electoral College as close as it is, but like the wild voting rights abuses that have happened and continue to happen, thanks to people like Paula Page, who himself said that the main election for Congress was a stolen election because there was ranked voting. Mm-hmm. Any way in which people's voices are actually heard, Paula Page is against.
Yes.
And while he's trying to say that his way of preserving a true America is by having white people continue to have their voices heard, he is hurting a true America by saying that not everyone should be able to vote.
Yeah.
And that is an assault on American democracy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, he is the loudest, most honest Republican
right.
on this issue and this philosophy. But I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it is the driving way of thinking about politics in American society and the Republican Party. Every single issue is viewed through a racial lens. And projection produces a Republican Party that accuses others of operating through identity politics. And yet, immigration is all about, oh my God, if they come in, then they're gonna vote and they're only gonna vote for Democrats, because obviously there's no reason they'd wanna vote for us, because we understand implicitly that our policies are not gonna benefit them. That's viewed through race. Voting rights is viewed through race. Fucking healthcare is viewed through race. It all is, I acknowledge that. It was quiet. That's a major issue going forward that they want to hide. Because, for instance, you talked about the difference between the votes that Hillary Clinton got and the votes that Donald Trump got. So how do they explain that away? Because obviously they don't want to exist thinking that justifiably millions more people oppose us than support us. What do they say? They say it's undocumented immigrants that are voting. So again, it's always, always, always comes back to race.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. Okay.
Well, why don't we move on to this ad? Should be a little bit of fun. On Twitter, I came across an ad for an apparel company that we will not name because I don't want to give them a single dollar in increased sales. And they choose to advertise for their products in a very particular way, targeting a very particular sort of American, as will become immediately clear.
Oh, beautiful, for heroes proved in the South, their country loved, and more than life.
Okay, so that ad was made by a madman, by a terrible, crazy person who believes insane things about our country.
This is porn. This is
yes.
Protest, beat up porn.
Because the person that you see at the end, who straps in with the visor and then deploys the baton, every guy, because it's only guys who are going to buy this clothes and stuff, wants to be that person. Not the person defending, the person attacking. They want to beat protesters. And this ad provides that sort of porn for them. They can put themselves in that position and think, wouldn't I love to attack these people? And they try to pretend that it's about cops and soldiers. And yet they throw, do they realize that like white football players aren't in the armed forces? Like they put people who stand when the flag is up on the same level as soldiers and police officers, in case the racial message there was not clear enough.
Yeah, aside from Villanueva and yeah. Anyways, yes, it's very frustrating to see this. Just all the different things. Those aren't actual protesters. Mm-hmm. This is just as fictitious as the Pepsi ad where a Jenner solves things with soda. Mm-hmm. But this is this strange, perverse fantasy that protesters are ready to just charge the cops full tilt. That is a fallacy. It read to me also like this scene in The Handmaid's Tale. Mm-hmm. Where someone from the armed forces starts opening fire on a group of protesters who are backing away.
Who are running away.
And in that world, they're the bad guys. You're the bad guy if you just are happy. And it seems like he relishes the desire, like beating up on protesters who are themselves already characterized in a false light.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's an Ocasio on one of the signs, right?
No, his name is Cortez.
Okay.
The name of, in a flashback to his football playing days in high school, he is Cortez, and they do that on purpose. Mm-hmm. And they do that in a way that's like, I went to the website that this is from. There are no Cortezes on their website. It's all white dudes in camo. Mm-hmm. They have a shirt that sells, it's called E to D. They have another shirt they have one that I liked called Wine Listens. I'm fine with that.
Wine Listens?
Wine Listens. It's like a drinking shirt. So this site sells like camo tees for white dudes. But if they had a white dude and people of color who are protesters, that would be, they know, a problem. So what they do is they get ahead of it. Cortez, we'll go with a Cortez guy, and possibly a little black too, I don't know. And then we'll also have all the protesters, by the way, are white. And they do that on purpose so that they can get around any obvious criticisms that would be there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's the same thing that we've been talking about all week, is that these people took control of the White House, Congress. They have a bigger majority. They already had a bigger majority in the Supreme Court. They control the governor's mansions. They control most of the state legislatures. They control. And that does not alleviate their fundamental fear, the world around them, 1%. They are every bit as terrified of everything. And the answer from their point of view is, if I fear it, kill it. And so that is why even with all the control that they have, they still are, they're a hair's width away from snapping. And we know that some do. People mail pipe bombs, people plan to assassinate members of the media and journalists. And all all that time that they are behind these attacks and that they're wishing, oh God, just give me an opportunity to use these weapons that I've been stockpiling. Give me an opportunity to use my baton. I just want to hurt somebody. Oh, also, the left are the dangerous ones. They're out of control. They're a mob.
What are
they again?
And that mob that, by the way, does not charge the police.
Yeah.
Is there, the signs seem like they're protesting police brutality, mm-hmm. which is glorified in this ad.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. We are unfortunately opposed by some incredibly twisted people. But we are going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue our series of breaking down the donors and financing of candidates in the 2020 Democratic primary, this time with Bernie Sanders after this. Okay, it's time to follow the money in the Democratic primary in 2020. Where are the donors? What are the corporations supporting? When it comes to these candidates, we've done a number of different candidates already. We turn now to Bernie Sanders, and joining the show to help break down the numbers behind the man, Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you, John.
Very glad to have you here, and I enjoyed your recent write-up about Bernie Sanders and his financial situation vis-a-vis this primary. So overall, how would you characterize the position he comes into this primary in terms of money compared to some of the other competitors?
He's entering the primary, John, in a position of significant strength, which if you look back to 4 years ago when Bernie Sanders came in as the ultimate dark horse against Hillary Clinton, he was a whole lot of nowhere. But here he is in February, now March, and he had several pots of money going for him right off the bat. Number one, he had about $9 million sitting in his U.S. Senate account, and that's money that he can transfer over to a presidential campaign. Number two, he had about $4.7 million or so sitting in his old 2016 presidential account. That too, he can transfer over to his current presidential campaign. And then, as Bernie Sanders was so excited to announce, he raised about $10 million right out of the gate for his 2020 announcement. Add that all up, Bernie's a $20-plus million man, and those numbers are already out of date because he's raising money constantly day in and day out. Relative to the other candidates in the race, he's about at the top of the heap, and that includes even some candidates who aren't in the race yet, like Beto O'Rourke or Joe Biden, if they ultimately get in.
Yeah, well, this is going to be an incredibly expensive primary, I have a feeling. And I want to turn to, what's that?
Without question.
Yeah, I want to move to multiple different areas of this. But first, I want to ask a question that I don't think gets talked about a lot in terms of Bernie Sanders. So in talking about the other candidates, we've been able to identify, in most cases, certain types of industries that are particularly supportive of them. When I think of Bernie Sanders financing, I don't generally think of corporate support, but I am curious. In your research, are there any industries that are more likely to support Bernie Sanders?
It's really a mixed bag. And the thing about Bernie Sanders, first of all, is that the way that federal finance, campaign finance accounting works, there's some stuff that you know and there's some stuff that you don't know. What you do know is that if anyone gives more than $200 to a political candidate or a political campaign, then they have to have certain information that gets attached to that donation, including their occupation and their employer. But Bernie, as we well know, back in 2016, he was so excited about the $27 donations that he was getting, the small dollar donations that were coming ultimately from hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people cobbled all together. That was some serious money. We don't get any of that kind of information for those kind of folks who are making those small dollar donations. From what we do know, the people who are giving bigger donations, retirees, sometimes people who were in industries that were service industries, retail, whatnot, even the financial industry, at least to some degree, was getting in. But it wasn't anything that compared to, say, what you would find with other candidates. He definitely wasn't getting a lot of oil and gas money. He wasn't getting money from folks who definitely were in industries that are in Bernie's political crosshairs. So that would be a differentiating factor for Bernie Sanders relative to some of the other candidates who are out there, Republican and Democrat.
So we know that one of the factors that's going to weigh into if you're able to make it as a candidate onto the debate stage is going to be your success in small dollar donations. So I kind of have an idea, but how's he doing in that area over the past few years?
Incredibly well. And this has been, Bernie's shtick, of course, all along is that, look, I'm not the candidate of the millionaires and the billionaires. I'm the candidate of the people. I am building my campaign not on super PAC support or big dollar money. I'm getting it from people who might not have a whole lot to offer, but are still going to get behind me, still going to make that $27 donation or $50 donation. For that matter, you know, a dollar or two. And a lot of people do make those small dollar donations. So as a result, Bernie is running a very different kind of campaign than many of the other candidates who are going to be running in the 2020 race. And he's somebody who's been very much at the forefront of saying no to different kinds of money and viewing certain types of political money as toxic or stuff that he doesn't want to touch. I would add one caveat to this, that as much as Bernie Sanders likes to talk about not having a super PAC and not playing the big money game, there's only so much he can do. And we did see that in the 2016 election where there was a super PAC. It was actually a nurses union super PAC that was quite supportive of Bernie Sanders. It wasn't to the degree of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump in terms of their super supports the PAC, but it does underscore the notion that super PACs, legally speaking, and by the nature of what they are not controlled by a candidate's campaign directly. Yeah. So if a super PAC wants to come and support Bernie Sanders or any other candidate that's running in the 2020 election, they have the ability to do so, even if the candidate, him or herself, doesn't want them involved.
So one topic that came up during the recent CNN town hall and that I've heard a lot about online, people who don't support Bernie Sanders bring this up quite a bit, has to do with his personal financial disclosures.
Sure.
And how he's been lagging on releasing his tax returns and things like that. To your knowledge, is there anything that gives us a reason in the case of Bernie Sanders to believe that something is being hidden, or like what are the stakes in this? People seem to believe that he might be hiding something. What is it that he's supposed to be hiding?
Well, of course, John, you don't know what you don't know. And mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders has had at least a certain track record with being less transparent than you might think he would be. Again, he talks a lot about big money in politics, too. He's talked a lot about political transparency or political openness. What we know is that he hasn't given over tax return information as some people would like him to. He says that he will and that will come soon, but that hasn't come yet. In 2016, the Center for Public Integrity, we reported that he basically ran out the clock when filing his personal financial disclosures that presidential candidates must file when they're running for president. This was something that happened in 2016. Bernie Sanders asked for two extensions, which he was entitled to, 45-day extensions. But by the time that those extensions had expired, Bernie Sanders was no longer running for president. And he said, oh, well, I'm not going to have to file anything because I'm not a presidential candidate. Well, that information is useful during the time when he is running for president. It wasn't very useful after the fact. And we didn't end up getting any personal financial disclosure information from Bernie Sanders until he had to file his reports many months later when he was doing so in the capacity of being a U.S. senator. So when you add that all up, that's interesting. And one final point I'd make, too, on transparency is the nonprofit organization that he's started back in 2016. This is a nonprofit that was out there to advocate for many of the policies that Bernie Sanders believes in and espouses. It had raised millions of dollars in 2016, 2017, and beyond. But what we found out from there, too, is that this organization, even though it's not by law, John, required to disclose its donors because it is a nonprofit, it has supported Bernie Sanders directly. It supported other political candidates directly. And all we're getting from them is just simply the names of people who've made a donation. We don't know where these people are from, if it's John Smith from New York City or Los Angeles or Topeka, Kansas. And we don't know the dollar amounts. In fact, this group has gotten a $100,000 donation that we know about, and we have no idea who that $100,000 donor is. That may seem like small potatoes compared to what some candidates are raising, but still, if you're going to run your campaign and really kind of stand on the platform of transparency and openness, this is something that has agitated at least a few Democrats out there saying, oh, Bernie's talking a real strong game, but maybe he's not living up to his ideals that he's putting forth.
Okay, and we'll be keeping an eye on that, and we'll see how that develops through the primary. Dave Leventhal, the Center for Public Integrity, thank you again for joining us.
Hey, thank you, John.
We're going to take a short break. We come back, closing out with a little bit of a fun back and forth with some creeps online. Some Democrats think that the topic of impeaching President Trump is still, do I want to go on the record? Radical, kind of, might get criticized. Not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was talking about it with Rolling Stone as part of a much bigger interview. And she said, yeah, no question. I don't even know why it's controversial. I mean, okay, it's not that I don't know why it's controversial. I understand that some people come from very tough districts where their constituents are torn. But for me and my community in the Bronx and Queens, it's easy. And she also talked about sort of the stakes in this and why it matters and why we don't have more Republicans coming over and acknowledging the serious crimes that appear to have been committed, as well as his incompetence and all of that. She says, in the Republican Party, there's a hostage situation going on. There are a lot of Republicans that know what the right thing to do is, not just on impeachment, but on a wide range of issues, and they refuse to speak up. To me, it's an unacceptable position because we're not in the realm of politics anymore. These are not questions of politics. These are questions of society. These are questions of equal treatment. These are questions of civil rights. Referring back to a couple of the big policy issues that have defined the Trump presidency. So to some Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, that's not difficult. You can just do that. You can say that.
It's not difficult to say, like, there are high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Acknowledge what is abundantly clear.
There are so many, and that's the narrative that's really been emerging lately, which is why are we waiting on a report from Mueller? Mm-hmm. Because all of those crimes are out there and obvious. And it was most striking to me the other day during the hearing with Michael Cohen at the end, the part that we were covering on the live stream, mm-hmm. which is one of the many things you get with membership on TYT, which is at the end, they're like, I would like these things submitted to public record. And some of those things were tweets that were saying, actually, Michael Cohen was very upset that he didn't get a job. They wanted those tweets mm-hmm. in the public record. The argument from the Republicans is that certain tweets of threats against Michael Cohen and his entire family aren't officially breaking the law, when I think we're just picking and choosing. And I guess my more holistic argument would be, of course, we're all picking and choosing. The impeachment is, while it's a, I guess, lawmaker proceeding based on the Constitution, which is like the original law of the land, it is such a political calculation, one that Pelosi has made on her side because she finds herself as more the person who has to keep things even keeled. But Ocasio-Cortez is saying quite explicitly, like, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me.
Yeah, and there are people, I guess, who have to make that sort of political calculation. But I've said for a long time, from my point of view, I don't care about the political consequences. Not that I don't care, but you do not enter into impeaching or not impeaching a president based purely on that. It's based on the substance. Did they commit the crimes? And no one, the Trump's chief defenders seem completely unwilling or uninterested in actually stating that he has not broken the law. They don't care about that anymore. For them, it is purely political about defending the presidency and by proxy, the Republican Party. There seems to be little disagreement that he has committed the crimes that would merit it.
Right. When it comes to high crimes and misdemeanors, you would have to be high to not see his crimes and misdemeanors.
Dun-dun-dun. Okay, let's transition to one more topic for the week. That was good. I like that. I just want to say that I am worried from time to time for AOC because the people who oppose her on the right do so in a really creepy way that we've seen in America over the past few years. They're universally men. It is the Republican Party, after all. And so they do things like this. Caleb Hull, who is a person, nobody knows. He's a Republican. I don't really care about him beyond that. Why is your chief of staff eating a hamburger? Shaking my head. And for some reason, we cut off the photos from that tweet. But the photos are photos of her and her chief of staff in a restaurant from behind, creepily taking a photo of them consuming food. And so she tweeted, tonight a dude was creepily and obviously taking a picture of me while pretending he wasn't, and I had to break his imaginary fourth wall and say, hi, I'm a person, this is weird. Because she is stalked by weirdos. This is not the first time, it won't be the last time. Other Republicans were gleefully retweeting this and saying, ha ha ha, look at her, she eats hamburgers and says you shouldn't, which isn't true, but we'll leave that for another time. And says, okay, so amplifying the creep shots is okay, got it. Just like the journo tweeting the photo of my backside was okay because that one was sent to him too, right? And so they all are getting in on this. They all love, just they're stalkers of AOC, obsessed with her. NRA TV is AOC TV. As you pointed out yesterday, CPAC is AOC PAC. They are obsessed with her to an extent that we haven't seen before. And they're going about it in a way that when you think about all the political violence coming from the right over the past few years, that really worries me for her safety.
It does. It's very disturbing. She's handling it quite well when really these are stalkers. And everyone wants to get her in that gotcha moment. I would say that each moment they have tried to get her on is not a gotcha moment. It is willful ignorance, which then becomes stupidity, of things she's actually said, when she's joking, when she's not. She said eat fewer hamburgers as a way to communicate something about the factory farm industry. Mm-hmm. she isn't gonna stop eating hamburgers.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's not asking you not to. But yeah, she's responding well, putting up a strong face, but she's got to be worried. They're talking about where she lives. They're trying to find her in her neighborhood. I would be terrified, and especially considering how important she is, I am worried for her. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you. As always, Brett, always good to have you on.
Great to be here.
You're what makes the Damage Report the Damage Report.
Aww.
So we'll see how that goes in
with
the future.
With John Iadarola.
Hey, that's my birthday. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Iadarola. I'll see you soon.